Welcome back to Prime Your Midlife, and in fact, welcome back to 2024. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and today we're talking to Dana Chapman all about gut health and how gut health can have a major influence on your overall health. We talk nutrition, talk habits, and we talk how your gut can literally change your life. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to Prime Your Midlife, and welcome, if you're watching this now, to 2024. And how are you with your resolutions? And perhaps one of your resolutions was to eat well and feel good. Well, today I've got a nutritional therapist with us today, Dana Chapman, and she's going to talk to us about the stuff down here. You can't quite see it, but our gut and how we eat, I think, can influence how we feel because of what happens in our gut. Is that about right, Dana?
It is indeed. Yeah.
How was your Christmas and New Year, first of all?
Fabulous. Thank you. Spent it with some family down in Wokingham. So always good to spend time with family and get a little bit of outdoors time as well, which is always nice.
And are you a resolutions person for the next year ahead, or you just take it as it comes?
No, I generally have never been one, because I'm always of the idea that if you want to make a change, why wait for anything? So I've never been, you know, the diet starts on Monday or let's wait for New Year to make some resolutions. If I want to make a change, I decide to do it and then I do it there and then.
Well, I know that there will be many people that will have resolutions or will just be thinking differently about the fact they've just consumed all that stuff over Christmas and New Year. And hey, we have to live, but also perhaps they've said, right, reset, reframe, and let's get focused on having a good, clean January, but maybe also making sure those habits apply to the rest of the year. I'm going to hit you with some quickfire questions just to enable people to answer themselves as to what the whole gut microbiome is. And then from that, we'll go into some deeper dive questions on some of those things. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, fabulous. Let's go.
So quickfire means that you have to say yes or no, or maybe, or give us the answer.
Okay.
Not long sentences, if that's okay.
Yep.
So first of all, can the gut influence our health?
Yes.
And in my gut, your gut, and everybody's gut, do we have live microbes in our gut?
We do. Many, many of them.
And can these be good and bad for us?
I prefer the terms beneficial and potentially non-beneficial.
Okay. And can food and drink we consume influence the number of microbes that we have in our gut?
Good question. And I don't know if I actually know the answer to that. They can definitely change the composition, but I don't know about changing the number.
Okay, interesting.
Hmm.
And if we have poor microbiome, can we correct that?
Yes.
And New Year's Eve, will alcohol be a good or a bad influencer for our gut microbiome?
Bad.
Okay. And does
we can
the
go
gut
into more detail on that later?
We will definitely. I'm just thinking about New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Okay. And does the gut affect our cognitive function?
Yes.
And are foods today that we consume more full or less full of bacteria?
Less full.
And final question, are all healthy foods, in terms of food that is labeled healthy, is healthy food necessarily good for our gut?
Oh, gosh, that's a difficult one, because lots of people like...
Yes or no? You could say maybe.
I'll say maybe.
All right. Wow. Lots of things to unpack there.
Yes.
First of all, I'm just curious about your own journey, Dana, as to why and how you got into nutritional therapy.
Oh, thank you so much. I do love telling the story, because it is a passion of mine that has been there since I was a chubby teenager. I didn't like the way I looked or I felt, so I wanted to make a change. And my mum was a classic yo-yo dieter, so I knew I didn't want to go down that route. So I started reading up about becoming healthy, because I thought if I become healthy, then I'll lose some weight. And the more I read, the more I was actually interested in what the information was saying about how food has such a profound effect on our body and on how we feel and on our skin health and on our energy levels. So that's where the interest really started. And all throughout university, I think I was one of the only ones who would cook from scratch and who would eat salads and again, spend money on magazines that were all about health and nutrition. But my first degree was not in nutrition. It was in accounting, and I became a consultant. And then I was lucky enough in 2013 to meet a nutritional therapist. And when she told me what she did, I said, that's exactly what I want to do. How did you do it? And she told me, I found out I could do it part-time. So I started studying part-time. I had to do A-level biology and chemistry to be able to get into the degree. And then I spent the next 7 years studying because somehow I had two children in between as well. But finally qualified about two and a half years ago now, and am able to follow my passion and work in an area that I absolutely love, which is understanding the physiology of the body and how to get the body to work better.
And it's fair to say that there's been a lot of focus on this word, the gut microbiome, in the last particularly 12 months with the advent of Zoe and people like Professor Tim Spector going on to some really big podcasts. Has that made you more in demand in terms of people being curious about this whole subject?
I would say very slightly. I think people are still looking for the quick fix, and they think that Zoe is that. And yes, I think Zoe is amazing for the general public in educating them on the role of the gut and the gut microbiome and why it's so important and how to nurture it. But where Zoe doesn't help is where there are specific gut health related conditions. If you've been suffering from poor gut health, that might not be enough. But I think it's a great step forward. And I think it is raising people's awareness of, okay, I do need to start thinking a little bit more about what I put into my body and how I look after my gut and my gut microbiome. So I think all in all, it's an amazing initiative.
You just talked there about thinking. And I know one of the questions we talked about at the start was cognitive impairment or cognitive function. Can you just help us break down in plain simple language the interplay between our gut and our brain as to how the two interplay communication with each other?
Yep. So when we are formed in utero, actually, the brain and the gut split from the same cell, and they are then connected by what we call the vagus nerve, which is a wandering nerve that attaches from the base of the spine, wanders all throughout the body, and attaches to the gut as well. And most communication between the gut and the brain happens through this vagus nerve. And actually, only 20% of signals go from brain to gut. 80% of signals go from the gut to the brain. So the gut has a large role to play in communicating to the brain lots of different messages that are important for the brain to know.
So when the brain sees threat, danger, does it then send a signal to the gut to say, I'm about to be attacked, or I'm about to feel stressed? And then what does the gut do with that signal from the brain back to the brain to then do a reaction?
So in that instance, what happens in stress to the gut is the gut actually shuts down in a stress response, because digestion is not key for running away from danger. So when the brain sees danger or perceives danger, because it doesn't need to be an actual danger, it can be a perceived danger, it's actually that vagus nerve gets activated and the adrenal glands are activated for the actual stress response. And then that vagus communication to the gut is shut down function, reduce stomach acidity, slow down motility, or empty, because I need to be clear of work so that the body has got more resources to then go and fight off whatever it is that you're being attacked by. The gut then can communicate to the brain that that process has happened. But what actually happens in stress as well is stress or an attack actually depletes the gut microbiome. So the composition of the gut microbiome then changes because of that stress response. So the interesting point there is that you can actually then eat foods and support your gut microbiome to support your stress response, for the gut to know, okay, the stress has gone. Let's calm down that stress response. Let's stop that activation of the stress response. So I suppose that's how the gut then communicates to the brain is, okay, all is well now. Let's just resume normal function.
And if we're talking about going through to the rest of the year, 2024, and it's now January, will having a good microbiome influence a greater chance of success with our mindset around this is going to be a successful year for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when your gut is functioning well and communicating to your brain that all is well, all is good, you're going to feel resourceful, you're going to feel happy and hopeful, and you will then have the motivation to carry you through for the rest of the year.
I'm going to just come back to that in a minute in terms of how the gut can influence perhaps mental anxiety or depression. But first of all, can you just explain to me what is actually the gut microbiome? Because we've all talked about it as a term, but actually maybe we just don't understand the basics of what exactly it is. And is it hundreds of millions of things in there that influences a gut microbiome? Is that okay?
Absolutely. It's actually 100 trillion is the latest number. So 100 trillion microbes. And this is specifically talking about the large intestine. So we've got bacteria all throughout the gastrointestinal tract, but the gut microbiome that we refer to is the 100 trillion microbial cells that live within the gut. And that can form, that can be of bacteria, viruses, what we call protozoa or parasites, and fungi. And all of those bacteria, parasites, fungi, and viruses live in what we call symbiosis with each other. So lots of people liken it to, for example, a forest where there's lots of different species of plants. It's the same for the gut microbiome. There's lots of different species of bacteria. There are a few different species of parasites. There are a number of different species of fungi and yeast. And all of those live in harmony with each other if we are supporting the gut microbiome through diet and through lifestyle, because it's not only diet that affects it as well.
And would you say that for a male and a female person, the gut microbiome has almost a parity of function? There is no difference to it or not?
Similar. So what women do actually have is something called the estrobilome, which helps break down estrogen and excrete it properly out of the body. So there will be a slight change in bacteria to help promote that in women, and men won't have that same effect.
What about age? Do we have a better microbiome as a child as we do an elderly or not, generally as an average?
Good question. So we thought that we were born with a sterile gut, but in actual fact, the research shows that we are probably not born with a sterile gut, but mode of birth, whether you were breastfed or not, and then eating food all helps the microbiome jump. And when we're about 2 or 3 years old, that's about the good base that you will have of your microbiome for until old age. So midlife, I think we actually start declining. Our gut microbiome starts declining because we know that as we age, we have less bacteria within the gut microbiome.
All right. So I'm just preparing to do my first shop of 2024, and I'm going physically down to my best supermarket, name you can decide.
Yeah.
And I'm wanting to go shopping in a way that's going to be good for my gut. Help me understand where I'm going to point my trolley, Dana.
To the periphery.
The periphery. Okay. And why would that be? Sorry, you carry on.
Yeah. So the periphery is normally where you get your fresh fruit and vegetables, where you might get animal meats, animal products, things like that. So I would do 80% of the shop on the periphery, because everything else is going to be processed. You go into any of the aisles and you pick up anything, the box is going to have at least 5 ingredients on it. And anything with more than 5 ingredients is definitely not good for our bodies. The only caveat I have is potentially an aisle where you've got beans and lentils that might be tinned. Those would be beneficial. Anything whole grain would be beneficial as well. So whole grain rice, potentially whole grain pasta. You get lovely chickpea and red lentil pastas these days. And all of those can be beneficial for the gut and the gut microbiome as well. But otherwise, stick to the periphery.
I heard a scary stat this morning, actually, that suggested that 76% of all foods that we're now consuming are highly processed.
Yeah.
Good or bad for the gut in terms of highly processed food?
Very bad.
For what reason?
They lack fiber, which means that you are starving your gut microbiome. They don't have many nutrients either, so you're not getting any nutritional value from it. But the main reason that it's not beneficial for the gut is because it lacks fiber and it lacks color. Often color helps feed the gut microbiome as well.
Can you help me understand something? In terms of these bacteria, microbiomes, can they survive the high temperature, dryness? And then equally, when they go through the stomach, obviously the stomach has a huge acidic value to it. These guys are, and girls, bacteria must be pretty hardy to be able to suddenly get in the gut and go, hey, party on, okay, we're here. What happens there? Are they just completely able to withstand all kinds of tolerances?
No, not at all. And especially, are you talking about things like probiotics or are you talking about things like yogurt or kefir?
Well, I'm just thinking about, you talked about the foods, the fresh food and vegetables, and we're inclined to maybe put them in a soup or we're inclined to puree them, bash them up, or they become inert in that they're dried. Lentil, for example, and then we put them in touch with liquid. How do we consume it in an optimum way so that when it hits the gut, it does its job?
So I think where the misconception or difficult confusion might come from is that not a lot of food contains bacteria itself. Right. So when you're eating things like beans and lentils, those beans and lentils don't have bacteria on them that are then going and inoculating your gut with bacteria. We have got bacteria in our large intestine. And when we eat things like beans and lentils, which are high in fiber, we can't break down fiber in the body, but the gut microbiome can. So the gut microbiome digests that fiber by eating it. And that's its fuel to survive. So our bacteria need to eat in the same way that we do to survive. So given the right foods, the right bacteria are going to thrive and you're going to get that symbiosis. So that's why we say having a high fiber diet is supportive of the gut microbiome because you are feeding the beneficial bacteria in the gut.
Wow. That's really shine a light bulb in my head on the basis that actually, I'm not trying to procreate by giving it more microbiomes. I'm actually giving it food that enables the microbiomes in there to survive and proliferate.
Yes. So slight caveat. So anything fermented will have live bacteria in it. And again, that is still beneficial to eat because often it comes from plant matter, which again will have both color and fiber, which both feed the gut microbiome. But fermented foods will slightly or have a inoculating effect on the gut. So in that way, you are eating bacteria that will have an effect on the large intestine because of that bacteria. But if anything is not fermented, that's when you're not eating that bacteria.
So examples of fermented food, kombucha, kimchi, the K's, kefir, that kind of, can you help us understand fermented foods that we could go and procure at the supermarket without having to go to the time and expense of doing it at home?
Yeah, exactly. So kimchi, kefir, kombucha, sauerkraut, miso paste, natto and tempeh. So tempeh is a fermented soybean. Those are the main sources of fermented foods.
And if I go to, I know I was in a shop yesterday beginning with them and they had a can of kombucha there.
Yep.
Is that actually okay for us on the basis that it's canned, it looks fairly processed, but if it says kombucha, is it actually going to do me any good?
Potentially. Again, I think it's not a regulated industry, is it? So it can say kombucha, and you just don't know how long it has been fermented for. So how you create things like kombucha is you use what's called a SCOBY, which is full of yeast. So kombucha is actually a yeast, it's not a bacteria. And you don't ever want a yeast overgrowth. So we should not be drinking the full 330ml can of kombucha first off. But how you make it is with this SCOBY, and then you put tea in it and you put sugar in it. And the sugar is to feed the SCOBY, and that ferments the tea, and is supposed to then ferment all of the sugar away as well. The stuff that we buy on the shelves potentially hasn't been fermented long enough to take all of that sugar out. So you might still be getting some sugar left in them. So I'd be careful about where I get my kombucha from, but rather look for some reputable sources, and don't drink the whole can.
I've got my SCOBY downstairs, believe it or not. I wish I'd brought him up to show you, but he has many different layers to him now. So if anybody knows me locally and they'd like a part of my SCOBY, then please feel free. It's like a piece of yeast that you pass through the generations.
Yeah.
I don't know where I got mine from. But yeah, it's a bit of a ritual. I have, and again, it's always still water, isn't it? We don't want to take it out of the tap. It's important to get water that's as pure as it can be.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Now, if I'm at a hotel, let's just say, and sometimes we do all of our best things to try to create a good 2024 for us, but then we are faced with choices that are prescribed to us on the basis that this is the buffet, this is the food and drink that's available to us today. And I've got a choice in my coffee break of having tea, coffee, water, or orange juice. Mm-hmm. What would be your pecking order? I'm thinking orange juice, yeah? Nice and rich and vitamin C.
I'd probably go for coffee. Coffee is fermented, actually. But coffee is full of what we call polyphenols. And again, polyphenols help feed the gut microbiome. So something like coffee would probably be my first choice.
And it's full of fiber as well, isn't it? Coffee, I think?
It is, actually, yeah. Yeah.
Orange juice then, not after that?
It depends. I was actually at a conference over the weekend and they said freshly squeezed orange juice actually may be beneficial, especially if it's got loads of the bits in it, because obviously you'll get some fiber from it. But a lot of the orange has actually been left over when you freshly squeeze an orange. So you're not getting as much fiber as you potentially should.
What about, there's a smoothie stand over there and I can see it's a jar of smoothie that says it's a smoothie.
Yeah.
Should I be skeptical about that? Or should I just think, yeah, that's going to be great for me?
Such a good question, because so many people think that smoothies are so good for them and they've thrown 5 or 6 different fruits in there. And yes, the fruit is good, but fruit on its own can increase your blood sugar levels, which can then lead to an imbalance of blood sugar levels, which is not good for our energy. And it's not good for our health long term either. So I always say when you're having fruit, try have it in its whole form. Or if you're having a smoothie, make sure you're having it with some protein and or fat. So some nuts or some seeds, some good protein powder like a pea protein or a hemp protein that's got fiber in it, but it's also got protein in it to slow down the digestion of those sugars from the glucose, from the carbohydrates.
All right. So we're just sitting down for lunch now at this hotel conference or during dinner, and we're presented them with the menu or the buffet in front of us. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to have a good microbiome and not then maybe also have a sugar spike in the afternoon, what would you advocate me picking either from the menu or the buffet to make me feel okay, and also not for everybody to go, oh, there's the vegan over there with all the rabbit leaves on the plate. Not that I'm against anything to do with rabbit leaves or veganism, but, you know, sometimes people sort of have a bit of stigmatism associated with the choices because they don't want to look like the person that's the health guru, and therefore they kind of go with the flow. Yep. What would you be telling me to do?
Definitely filling half of your plate with vegetables if they are available at the buffet, because that's going to give you your fiber and it's going to give you your color that's going to be helping to feed your gut microbiome. if it's an amazingly fancy place, they might have some nuts and seeds as well that you can sprinkle on top of your vegetables or your salad, because that always raises the level of a salad or vegetables. And things like olive oil, again, is amazing for the gut microbiome. So really dose up the olive oil on a salad if you don't typically like salad, because it's generally quite dry and limp. And then protein. Protein is always so essential. Yes, it can be in a vegan or vegetarian form. So eggs or beans or lentils. So something like beans or lentils, again, will be feeding the gut microbiome, but they're not as rich in protein as something like a chicken breast or some steak or whatever meat option they have available. So if you're wanting energy for the afternoon, I'd definitely be saying have some animal protein on the plate and then a small portion of carbohydrates. So something like wild rice, if they've got that, or potatoes are okay. But just watch the portion size. So the portion size for carbohydrates on your plate should always be about the size of your fist. If you're going above that, you're at risk of falling asleep in the afternoon slot.
And in order to make these gut microbiome thrive and be at their best, is there a sequence as to which foods we consume when? So we sit down, and of course, we get the bread first before anything else happens. What do you advocate in terms of trying to be really good on the sequencing of food that's enabling the gut to perform at its best?
So the gut doesn't necessarily need any sequencing. It will process whatever food comes to it, but it's the blood sugars that that you can affect by what you eat first. So by eating the salad first, you may then be reducing the impact of the glucose or the carbohydrates that are coming in later on in the meal. So you have better glucose tolerance. I will actually put my own caveat to that. If you're having a salad before a meal that has got things like rocket or watercress in it, that's actually going to help produce stomach acidity. And that's not something that we've spoken about yet, but stomach acidity is very important for starting the digestion process. And if you don't have a strong enough stomach acidity, you're not going to be able to digest the food that you're eating sufficiently. And that can land up in the large intestine, and then it can be potentially non-beneficial because the food isn't digested properly, and the wrong microbes can then feed and proliferate in that way.
One of the things we started off on, and I know it's one of your specialties, is actually the mental health impacts of how the gut can create good and bad thought processes.
Yeah.
Can you just help us understand that as we go into January and we're going to probably come into the 20th of January and we're going to feel as though we've lost our mojo, it's dark, we haven't got anything to look forward to, and then we start to go for those foods that sometimes satiate us quickly and give us a nice, comfortable, comfy, you know, people talk about comfort food and and going for the things that make us feel good, but then we kind of dip and get a bit dark and depressed after that. Why is that, and how can you help us with that, Dana?
I think there's about two or three questions in there. So let me try.
Sorry. Let me try. Break it down as to whatever order you want.
Let me try answer them in total somehow. The gut and the gut microbiome are important for our mental health. Yes, absolutely. We know that the gut microbiome is important for creating a lot of our serotonin. Serotonin is our happy hormone. When we don't know if that serotonin actually reaches the brain, most people think that it actually doesn't, but serotonin still has a large role to play in the body. But the gut is also responsible for creating dopamine, which is that reward center in the brain. And it's important for creating what we call GABA, which is our anti-anxiety neurotransmitter. So the gut is important for creating neurotransmitters, but to be able to create neurotransmitters, we need to have the raw materials for that. And this is what we often don't understand. We think our bodies work by magic, and yes, they do, but they need the raw ingredients for that magic to happen. So for example, serotonin, which is our happy hormone, is actually made from tryptophan, which is an amino acid. But it goes through a number of conversion processes, and those conversion processes need vitamins and minerals, such as magnesium, B vitamins, iron. Now, if our gut is not functioning properly, we're not digesting the food that we're eating effectively, which means that we may not have those nutrients available to be able to create our neurotransmitters for us to feel happy, for us to feel rewarded, and for us to not feel anxious. So there's always two or three pronged approach. Our bodies need the raw ingredients first. So we need to be getting those raw ingredients in the diet, but our gut needs to be functioning well to then have those ingredients to be able to create those neurotransmitters. Now, some people, yes, when they feel low, go and seek those high fat, high sugar foods. And the reason is because when you eat those high fat, high sugar foods, we get a little bit of a serotonin boost, actually. And so you feel good for about 5 minutes afterwards, but it very quickly dips away because it's a false serotonin boost. It's not from tryptophan, which is protein. So really, if you are feeling low, you should be going for the fats and the proteins to help support your mental health in the long term, rather than for the 5 minutes after you've eaten said food.
And therefore, what am I going to put in my fridge or my cupboard? So when I've got that desire to make myself feel a little bit better because I'm having a bad day or because it's dark,
What
would you recommend that I put in my trolley that then goes from the shop to my home to make it easy to have when I'm feeling triggered?
You know, I always love things like dark chocolate. So dark chocolate is loaded with magnesium. Magnesium is one of the nutrients that are needed for our neurotransmitters. I always say magnesium is nature's tranquilizer. So it helps us feel calm and it helps us feel happy. And we are quite deplete in magnesium these days, actually. So it's a key nutrient to really seek out in foods and potentially look at supplementing. But something like dark chocolate would be amazing.
Percentage of dark chocolate that we should try to get? The more the better, I guess, or not?
The more the better, definitely. But anything over 70% will offer some benefit. So most people say 80 to 85 is best, which I agree with. But if you haven't ever tried dark chocolate, then maybe starting off with a 70 and trying to go higher might be something to aim for.
And even just on that, if we're looking at the branded aspect of dark chocolate, you can get the basic sort of cooking dark chocolate, and then you get the full branded variety that has all the nice packaging. Is the essential ingredient the percentage of cacao in it that matters to the gut?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And the higher the percent, the less the sugar, and sugar is going to feed the non-beneficial bacteria in the gut. So that's another reason why to aim for the higher percentage, is because A, it's going to have more of the ingredients that feed the beneficial bacteria and less of the ingredients that are going to feed the non-beneficial bacteria. But other foods that you can think of having in the cupboard are things like kefir, and making something like a smoothie when you're feeling low like that, or making yourself something like an apple crumble, because stewed apples are actually really amazing and beneficial for the gut, actually. And you can top the apple crumble with something like oats and almond flour and some cinnamon, which are all amazing for the gut microbiome.
So the more spices, so it's not necessarily foods, it's spices. So a bit of nutmeg on there, a bit of cinnamon on there, a little bit of brown sugar, all these nice little things that we can chuck on top of the apple crumble. I'm feeling really hungry now. I can smell it almost from the oven downstairs.
Oh, yeah, so herbs and spices actually both help feed the gut microbiome and are really beneficial
I've heard somewhere that we should ideally aim for 30 a week. Is that about right?
So 30 different plant foods a week, yes. But that, again, includes all fruit, all vegetables, nuts, seeds, beans, and lentils.
Okay. We're going through January and we committed to dry January. It's now the 1st of February, and I think, right, that's it. I'm going to have a complete and utter bender. Good or bad for the gut microbiome? We've just had a really lovely January. We filled it full of nice nuts, pulses, seeds, 30 vegetables, no alcohol. And right, crack on then. Let's get absolutely wasted.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely not beneficial. Think about when you go for a blood test. What do they do to your arm before they stick the needle in?
They've normally put a band or something around my muscle to increase the blood pressure so that the blood flies out.
Yeah, but they also wipe your skin with an alcohol swab.
True.
Clear all the bacteria on your skin. Yeah.
So by pouring that into our gut, then basically we're doing all the good that we've done, we're kind of destroying.
Yeah.
Literally, yeah. Are we destroying our gut when that happens, or are we just not filling it with food that enables it to be at its best?
No, you are actually destroying your gut. Yeah, wow. Destroying the gut microbiome.
Any alcohol that might be good? Are we thinking red wine or anything, or is just it's a.
You know, I'm not against drinking alcohol. I drink it myself, but I have it on occasion, and I try not go overboard. So, you know, you might. Lots of people say red wine is great because of the resveratrol, but there's not been one human study done on resveratrol. It's all been in animals. Mm. So we don't know what benefit it has. And think about it as well. If you are out and enjoying a meal and enjoying some alcohol with that, it's the whole atmosphere, isn't it? You're getting so much joy and fulfillment from that atmosphere that may potentially then negate the effect of the alcohol at that particular point in time. So think about the blue zones as well. They also drink alcohol, but it's in that setting of, you know, I'm relaxed, I'm enjoying a meal, I'm having a good time with friends. So in that way, enjoy alcohol in those occasions. But I would always say, think about enjoying it moderately to help support your gut microbiome.
It's so deeply ingrained, isn't it? When we say, let's go out for a drink, immediately we think alcohol as opposed to something else. What about things like, so I'm a great fan of Nozeco, for example. It still has that sort of pomp of the bubble. And it's is that okay?
Yes. And actually, you get kombucha bottles like that as well now. So a 750ml kombucha, and you can each have a glass of fizz. That's actually then going to be beneficial.
Nice. Back to the whole aspect of mental health. I understand also you are very much focused on the ADHD aspects of the gut and how that can or can't help somebody that is diagnosed ADHD. Can you help us explain why that's important to you, Dana?
Yeah, again, it's one of the reasons why I went into mental health in the first place is it's an area where people think that the only option is medication. Whereas it's not, and I'm not saying medication is a bad thing because some people do need it and it does support some people. But the reason why I went into mental health in the first place was because nobody was talking about the gut and what we can do from our own physiological perspective to support our mental health. And the same goes for ADHD. We know that individuals with ADHD have really struggle to produce dopamine, and that dopamine is made in the gut. So trying to help support those conditions by supporting the gut and the gut microbiome to be able to create that dopamine internally so that you don't always seek it externally. But there's also a lot of nutrient imbalances with ADHD. So often copper and zinc are out of balance. Often copper is very high in ADHD, and copper and zinc work in opposition to each other. So when copper is high, it drives your zinc low. And zinc is very important for brain health and brain function. And a lot of people with ADHD really struggle with that brain function. And again, magnesium, which is what I've already spoken about today, but often people with ADHD are very low in magnesium, and it's because of the always on. When we are in a state of stress or when we are on always on mode, we're depleting those magnesium stores. So thinking about the magnesium balance is also quite important. And that's just a few of the elements that can really help people with ADHD.
Linked also to mental health, the aspects of dementia, Alzheimer's, and then almost other chronic conditions of diabetes and cancer.
Yeah.
Is there any aspect of correlation between bad microbiome and any of those health conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say almost all of them have a link to the gut and the gut microbiome. Interestingly enough, still part of the gastrointestinal tract, but a lot of people with Alzheimer's, they've done a recent study where they've done autopsies and found that I think 80% of the people with Alzheimer's had an imbalance of bacteria in their mouth. So when we're talking about microbes, we have microbes everywhere. We have microbes on our skin. We have microbes in our mouth, in our stomach, in our small intestine, and in our large intestine. So we've got to kind of be thinking about it all the way down. But definitely links to dementia, links to Parkinson's, because Parkinson's, again, is a dopamine thing, but very strong links to the gut microbiome and gut health. And then when you're talking about the type 2 diabetes, this is one of the Zoe study aspects, is how do you gain better blood glucose control? And it's through certain microbes that you do that. So supporting the gut and the gut microbiome helps in things like type 2 diabetes. And then when you think about heart disease, all of those aspects impact heart disease as well.
So we are really making everyday choices that future proofs us for future health in terms of today's choices create today's future.
Yeah. And, you know, I always say you've worked your whole life and, you know, if you're nearing mid-age, you are in your final years of working, you want to enjoy your retirement. You don't want to have saved up all that money and end up with a condition like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, and you're not even able to enjoy the money that you've spent your whole life working to save.
Yeah. What about supplementation? I know you talked about medication, but supplementation, we have literally bombarded all the time with advertisements about take this, take that, creatine, tablets, supplementations, omega-3.
Yeah.
What's your view on all of those?
I love using supplements, and I think it's because we don't get enough nutrients in our diet on a daily basis because we're not eating amazing diets, firstly, but our soils are really depleted and our stress levels deplete our nutrients even more. Caveat to that, if you are on medication, always seek advice from a healthcare professional such as myself, because nutrients, vitamins, minerals, and herbs can interact with medication. So it can stop the medication from working, or it can increase the medication within your body. So definitely always check with a healthcare professional before supplementing. Supplements are not all made equal. It is not a regulated industry. It comes under food and science safety. It doesn't come under drugs and drug use. So it is not a regulated industry. Certain companies do go through a specific manufacturing process. So they've got a stamp that they have gone through that manufacturing process. And that is what you should look for when you're buying any vitamins or minerals, because with that stamp, they are saying that they've tested every single capsule and it has what it says on the back of the pot that it has. Mm. And again, we can get so drawn into the marketing of these supplements that they're always so amazing for us. Supplements take longer to work than medication. So if you are considering taking supplements, ask yourself before, what am I hoping to achieve? Is this supplement going to help me achieve it? Take that supplement for at least 3 months and then reevaluate. Is it helping me? Do I feel an effect? If not, stop it. Otherwise, you're wasting your money. Mm. If you do feel an effect, then great. But what people don't often do is give themselves long enough to actually feel the effect, or check in after 3 months to go, actually, is this helping me or isn't this? But again, seeing someone like myself, a healthcare provider like myself, I then recommend supplements for specific reasons. So for example, if somebody is coming to me with depression and or anxiety, I'd definitely be considering things like omega-3. I'd definitely be considering things like high-dose B vitamins, because they're so important for our neurotransmitter production. And things like saffron have been shown in the research these days to be very beneficial in things like poor mental health. So somebody like myself who's got the training to understand what you need and to put you on a supplement that is going to be effective enough so that you start to notice the difference from it.
And obviously, we'll put all of Dana's details in the show notes so that you can go and find her website. And on her website, I've seen it, there's lots of tools and resources there. I'm just curious, you've obviously got two boys and I've got two boys, and they are being bombarded all the time by advertisements and also their peers having to fit in. How do you try to foster a good relationship for them with the food and drink that they're consuming and making choices on?
Can I tell a quick funny story?
Of course.
The other day, my son said to my husband, you know, it's good having a mum who's a nutritional therapist, but sometimes it's actually not so good because we don't get ice cream every night. And it's really difficult. It's such a difficult line to cross, isn't it? I don't stop my children from having things like ice cream, but it's a once a week that we go out for it. I'm trying very hard not to call it a treat, because it's not a treat for our bodies. And then I talk to my children about, you know, it's fine to have food that is not beneficial for our bodies. I don't like the words healthy and unhealthy, because what does that actually mean? So I try to educate them on, at home, the majority of the time, we're going to be trying to eat foods that are beneficial for our body. We're going to be feeding our bodies with food that has nutrients that helps the body perform the functions it needs to perform. Although I'm not saying that to my 6 and 8 year old. I'm just saying we're going to eat food that is beneficial for our body. And yes, sometimes we can go out and have a pizza and that's not going to be so beneficial. But hey, we're going to go out and have fun and enjoy it because it's an enjoyable experience. Sometimes going out with a 6 and 8 year old is enjoyable.
But even the context of ice cream, you know, ice cream can have a broad spectrum of, you can have a really nice quality, well-made ice cream with egg yolks and natural dairy products. That is good. And yet you can have others that are highly processed, full of lots of flavorings and artificial things that is not so good.
And so when we go out for ice cream, we've got a local gelato place that I know it's great quality. So if we go out and have something like that, I just try and make sure that it's the best quality that it can be. And the same goes, I don't often do baking, but if I do, it's baking with things like maple syrup rather than just plain sugar. And I've got some oats in there and some seeds in there, or I try use a nut flour that's going to balance out the sugars. And so I try to do baking in that way. So it's not about depriving yourself. If you want a muffin, why not make a paleo muffin that's got carrots and dates and bananas in it, rather than let's go make a chocolate chip with white flour and white sugar.
But a lot of it is your positive enforcement of language that connects why we do this to the benefit, as opposed to you must not do this because mum says so.
And I think that's really the way that it should be, shouldn't it? We shouldn't be demonized for the food that we eat if we enjoy it. But, you know, we've got to be feeding the body the things that it needs to support us into old age.
And when you go out for dinner or you're in the classroom, you're on a school run, are you optimistic or pessimistic associated with the future generations of where they're going with food and the way that food is now mass produced as a commodity to create profit?
I'm very saddened, especially at the school gates, just seeing the amount of rubbish children are brought. Maybe they're asking for it at home, but it doesn't seem that parents are very educated on what's going to be a beneficial snack for when they pick their children up. But also in saying that, I mean, let's bring it out to other generations as well. If we are eating food that we've not prepared, you've not prepared your body for that first step of digestion. So looking at your food, smelling your food while it's cooking is instructing your stomach to start producing stomach acidity. So when we are rushing from A to B, grabbing a croissant, eating it on the way, not only are you doing detriment to your gut microbiome because you're eating food that's lacking fiber, but you're also your body's not primed to digest that food. So it's not going to digest it properly, and you're going to be at much higher risk of things like acid reflux. So yeah, there's lots of reasons why I am quite disheartened when I think about future generations, because there's so much food out there that is cheap that people are just filling themselves up on. Mm. Yes, there is an economic crisis at the moment, but think about the cost of a potato compared to the cost of, you know, a packet of white pasta.
Mm-hmm.
We can start thinking about eating in a cheap way. And we spoke briefly about the Smiles trial earlier. The Smiles trial, actually, they compared the basket of foods to what people normally bought. And the basket of foods on the Smiles trial was actually cheaper because they used frozen fruit and vegetables and tinned beans and lentils and tinned food, which was actually reasonable. So we need to be thinking about, you know, yes, money can come into what we choose to buy, but what we choose to buy can still be reasonable. A carrot won't cost you even a pound.
Yeah. But sometimes the kickback is, yeah, but then I haven't got time. You know, I haven't got time to get all those produce. I haven't got time to peel the potatoes. I haven't got time to put it in the slow cooker. I just need to go for the quick hit. And my boys have come home from school really hungry and they just want quick food now. What's your rebuttal against that person that might be listening to say, yeah, but I haven't got time?
Well, an apple and a handful of nuts is quick. To scramble a couple of eggs is quick. To open a tin of baked beans is quick. You know, cut up a carrot and dip it in hummus. That's quick.
Hmm.
Yeah. An oat cake in hummus or peanut butter on an oat cake. That's all. And I know those are more snacks, but if you're thinking about a meal, scrambled eggs and an avocado, job done. Maybe throw in some smoked salmon or something like that. It doesn't need to take long. Something like cooking a piece of salmon and throwing some broccoli into steam is going to take 10 minutes. You don't have 10 minutes?
Yeah. Okay, two things.
We choose to spend our time, isn't it? As well?
Absolutely. Two final things. Time for sleep and also time for rest of the gut in terms of things like fasting.
Mm.
Can you help us understand those two doctrines of good sleep and rest for our gut?
Yeah. So the gut microbiome actually has its own circadian rhythm, but the gut microbiome can help support good sleep as well. So helping support the gut microbiome should help support your sleep. And then melatonin, which is our sleep hormone, is actually made from serotonin. So just a side there. And then your other question, remind me again, what were your other questions?
Was whether or not we should allow our gut to rest for a certain period from the last food to the next food that we eat and why, if we should.
Yeah, definitely. So the gut actually needs to do a clear through and a heal. The gut lining regenerates every 3 days. So we need to be giving the gut that time to rest and repair between. So we should actually be eating every 4 to 5 hours, not every 2 to 3, to give ourselves that rest during the day. But overnight, at least 12-hour fasting overnight.
Wow, so much from this 45 minutes so far that we've discussed. And you know, I really appreciate you for the wisdom and expertise. Obviously, Dana's information will be in this. What are you planning for 2024 to try to broadcast your message to more people, Dana?
Yeah, good question. As I said, I'm trying to go a lot more into ADHD. And so I'm wanting to work alongside a lot of coaches who coach ADHD people, because I think it's a really nice synergy between us. And then just more things like this, podcasting and corporate workshops as much as I can, just to get that message out about how we can be supporting our own health through what we eat and what we do.
Well, the fact that you've studied for 7 years and today you've brought in some really complicated language, but also simplified it to make it easy to understand. So I'm sure that you'll do really, really well on that.
Thanks.
Just to close, if we're thinking about making 2024 as good for us and also as good for our relationships and our gut, what would be your three key recommendations to leave us with, Dana?
spend time in nature. That's one thing that we haven't actually spoken about, but spending time in nature helps reduce the stress response, but it also supports your gut microbiome. So at least an hour in nature if you've got the time every day. Otherwise, 10 to 15 minutes is going to be beneficial for you. Then the second would be every time that you eat, you can ask yourself, am I healing myself or am I doing detriment to my body? And I go for the 80-20 rule always. So 80% of the time, if you're feeding yourself food that's beneficial for your body, then your body will be able to cope with the 20% that you're not. So ask yourself every time you eat, am I giving my body the things that it needs to perform optimally? And then third would be whenever you eat, slow down, enjoy it, smell your food so that your digestion process is as effective as it can be, chew your food sufficiently so that your digestion process can be as beneficial as it can be. And just try and enjoy it. I mean, food is so joyful, isn't it? I think that's another reason why I went into what I do is because I love food so much. So let's enjoy food and enjoy the process around it as well.
Beautiful. So get in nature. 80-20 would suggest that we can still live without being completely ruthless on every decision we make. And also, so not doing this then. So I'm not kind of just sat there looking at my phone, scrolling and eating. That's not something you'd advocate?
No, not beneficial.
Beautiful. Thank you so much today, Dana, for helping us kickstart 2024 in a way that's good for us and also good for our guts. And then the two are going to help us conquer and achieve all of the things that we set out to do this year. Thank you. And many good wishes for you and your family for the rest of the year ahead.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been fabulous.
Thank you. So there it is, another episode of Prime Your Midlife. And as always, I'll ask you, what are you going to do with that information? What habits can you change? Who can you share it with? And how can you take accountability of what you've just listened to? This is Prime Your Midlife. Please help me grow the network by sharing, liking, or commenting. Remember, one life, love life, living life.